I'm here in Woodtown Park House, and I'm talking to Christopher Moriarty. Christopher, Kerry background, would that be
Kerry
right?
from a few generations ago, yes. And they were more or less run out of the country, out of that part of the country, because an ancestor went to a gospel meeting intending to throw tomatoes or something at the preacher. The preacher preached in beautiful Irish, and my ancestor was so impressed that he became a member of the Church of Ireland and became a clergyman in
Oh, and that was the reason. And where did that information come from now? Did it come down through the family orally, or?
It's sort of traditional, and I've never actually looked into the looked for written details about it, but we've that has been in the family for a few generations.
Tell me about your father. What was your father doing, and do you remember him?
I remember him very well. He lived into his 80s, and he was born in Omagh, in or near Omagh, in County Tyrone, where his father was the rector of Cappagh Parish. But my father got a job in the Tote, in the horse racing Tote, when it was founded, and became manager of it a few years at quite an early stage, and remained in that job, and definitely became a Dubliner. So I was
And where
born
was the family house?
family house. I was born in Rathfarnham Park, which is in the Dodder Valley, and the Dodder is really, in a way, one of my earliest memories. We lived there for until I was 19, and then we moved just a little way up the hill to Ballyboden. And I've lived around here in the Dodder Valley most of my life, apart from a couple of years in Nigeria.
Well, born in 1936, that would make
Yes.
that at the age of 19, that would have made you. We were in the, we were in the war years, weren't we? At that stage,
Well, that was 55,
55.
1955, after the war. All right, I was in college at that time,
Do you remember the war
but I
years,
remember the
then?
war very well, yes. And a few particular points. I remember on the Pierce Bridge on Rathfarnham Road, must have been quite early in the war, but they put up tank barriers on the bridge, and they also they drilled holes in it for explosive charges so they could blow the bridge in the case of invasion. I gather they did this in all of the bridges on the Dodder to slow down any army attempting to invade Dublin. So I well remember those being put up, and well, they were large concrete blocks with steel spikes on them, but with space to cycle through and space in the middle for transport.
Well, and did you was there news coming from Europe about the state of the war? Or were you too young at that stage really to kind of pick up on that?
No, well, I suppose I was probably getting more aware of it towards the end of the war. I'd only been 3 when it broke out, and then I was nine at the end. So I definitely remember my father listening to the news every day fairly anxiously. He used to listen. He would listen to BBC News, and they had a. If there was an Allied victory, they had a little dr they beat a drum signal, dot 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 dash, which is the Morse code for V, for victory. I remember a few of those very well, and I remember the odd plane flying overhead, and if my father was there, he would have his binoculars out to identify it. But and then, of course, there were bombs quite very close to us in Rathdown Park. But I don't remember the year, but I certainly remember the bombs.
That's interesting. And so your father was very clued in to what was going on then.
Oh yes, but I think everybody was. It was certainly people were fully aware of.
But your schooling days then, where were you educated?
Mostly boarding school, a prep school, Castle Park in the Ardoki, and then St. Columba's, which is just across the way from where we are.
Were you a day boarder?
No, I was a boarder. My father believed very strongly that boarding schools were good for the soul, or good for everything. I think partly because he had been, he was brought up in a country rectory, and he was sent to boarding schools in Dublin. And I think he was probably happier in a boarding school than he might have been day school, because he was in a quite an isolated home.
And were you happy in those days in boarding school, or how did you?
Yes, I look back on them with quite a lot of anger, and I consider that I would probably have been much happier at a day school. But no, I have to say I actually was happy in them. Yes, and I liked them both. Yeah.
When you finished with boarding school, did you want a third level, or did you finish
at
that stage?
Went to Trinity then and did natural science. And then I got a very bad primary degree. And I had hoped to, or I started natural science. I definitely obsessed by science. And particularly by wildlife. So I studied that, got hopelessly diverted in college, particularly into Players, the Dramatic Society. So even, I couldn't act, but I was good on stage lighting. And so I got very much involved in that. I believe I got a very good education in Trinity. Unfortunately, I was so busy doing the other things that the degree suffered.
Who were your lecturers in UCD, or in the Trinity?
Were quite distinguished and really established themselves very well. David Webb was professor of botany, and was definitely one of the leading European botanists. And then I had Frank Mitchell in geology. Frank was a brilliant teacher and lecturer. He wrote a number of really top-class books on the topography of Ireland. He was really a quite outstanding person.
You were lucky to have such good teachers, but you didn't fare out that well, even though you loved the subject.
I loved the subject, but I spread things just a lot too thinly. Also, I suppose one of the problems, I don't have a good memory. So, and to get a good science degree, you need to remember an awful lot of facts. Far more facts than you would need in English or in one of the literary subjects. History is probably about halfway between science and English. But English, you can get away with a lot of thought, which you cannot do in science.
Where did that leave you now?
So that left me, decided I wanted to be a freelance writer. I started writing halfway through college. I got articles published in the Irish Times, and then I wrote a lot in the evening press because Douglas Gageby was editor at the time. I got to know him very well and wrote a lot for them. And so I tried the journalism and failed. I'm a good writer. I don't have the neck that's needed for to be a good reporter. So I barely survived on that. And
what
then,
were your articles? I mean, what were you writing about?
Heritage mainly, wildlife, archaeology, recent history, and so on. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's been my main part of my writing ever since. Then after the, I I had a very fairly miserable 6 months or so, and I'd applied. I was about to go to interview for a job in an English school. That seemed to be the only hope. And then, by extraordinary good luck, I was introduced to a man in the fisheries service, and he took an immediate liking to me. And I showed him my press cuttings book, and he said, "That's not past degree stuff. You should, you're better than that." And that was very cheering. And as it happened, there was a research studentship vacant. It had been advertised, nobody took it up, so they re-advertised it. I applied. There was one other person applied who was much better qualified, but who didn't want to give up the job. He wasn't free at once, and I was. So I got it. And about a year, and that was for a study of the fish in the Blessington Lakes. And so I set out on that, and it went very well. And then Erskine Childers was the minister in charge of fisheries at the time, and he wrote down quite a number of questions, something he wanted information on, and he sent it to the chief scientific advisor, who for some reason sent it down to a junior, one of his juniors, and instead of trying to answer the questions, the junior said it would be impossible to answer these questions without a great increase in staff. And Childers said, "Right." And they created five scientific jobs. And that was
That was a lucky
1959.
stroke for you.
And, oh, yes. I mean, makes me, I sort of have some, can't help believing that there's something outside is working to help from time to time, because there's just too many coincidences.
And this was
See,
19
that was
or
19,
1990,
that 59,
59.
59, yeah.
Yes.
So I got a job there, and I stayed with it for, well, for more than 40 years. Just apart from, I took got leave of absence for 2 years to work in a university in Nigeria and to set up a fisheries course there.
Well, take me through some of those 40 years that you. What were the highlights? What were the ups and downs in that time?
The work was always interesting. The company was always very, very good, and the colleagues were very nearly all a really pleasant lot to work with. So you look forward to going to work. I got my PhD there. That was for a study on eels. And this again came indirectly from Childers. At the time, in the 50s, there was an eel fishery in Lough Neagh, which was worth, it employed about 400 people and was worth a great deal of money. And Childers said, "Why don't we have, we've got as much water down here as they have in Lough Neagh, why don't we have as good a fishery?" So I was told to do eels. And so I looked at the fishery as it was and found out what I can about could about it, and also went to the continent a little bit to see how they fished for eels there. The eel, by the way, it is one of the most highly priced fish in the business. It's for some reason we don't eat them in Ireland, but most of the countries where you get eels, you pay more per pound of eel than you do for nearly anything else.
Why do you think that is? Is it just our way of our habits, that we just because there was a tradition in the south of Kerry to have eel for a Christmas dinner. Did you not know
Right,
that?
I didn't know that, and that is quite unusual. Yes, and you do meet people all over the country. I mean, who fish for eels and who do eat them. Yes. But you won't be able to buy an eel in a fish shop.
No,
You
no.
can't, and if you can't do that, it means there's no demand.
Okay. being involved in what you were doing, were you also writing at the same time?
I was, yes. Yeah. And actually the job entailed travel all over Ireland. And so I would write articles on what I was doing and what I was seeing and so on.
Now, where were you living at this stage?
I was living, I had a flat near the centre for a few years, and then I lived with my parents for a few years after that. And when I got married, I came out here.
To this beautiful historical house.
Yeah.
How did you find this place? I mean, it's just magnificent.
Yeah, I had known of its existence, but it just happened that a family who had lived here for a long time, they were friends of my parents and told my parents that they were going and in case I might be interested in it. So I moved in after they left.
What year?
And well, that was 67. That was the year I got married. Stayed there for 3 years, and then the problem was it was a completely insecure tenancy, and so I, even though we loved the place, we really couldn't risk staying. The owner, Arnold Marsh, was he was in his 80s. He had just one daughter who wasn't living here at the time. And so we didn't know what was going to happen when he died. The daughter might, we felt there was quite a risk, the daughter would have sold up and we would have been out on our ear. The tenancies were much, things were much more in favor of the landlord then. So we bought a house in the suburbs in Stillorgan, and then we moved to Monkstown for a few years. Then another extraordinary sequence of events. We went to Nigeria in 1976, came back in 79, and by that time Arnold Marsh had died and his daughter Ethna and her family had moved in here, and they had decided that they were going to continue to run the place as it had been in apartments. And another of these extraordinary bits of good luck came along. I had been doing a lot of work on the eels in Loch Derg, and a friend I used to stay with there said his neighbour wanted to sell a quarter acre of a piece of land beside the lake. Would I take it? So, the price was high. I had damn little money, but I said to myself, look, when something like that happens, you take it up. And so I did. I thought, well, okay, maybe I'd get a mobile home on it or something like that. And then 1979, the owners of this flat left. And
this is an apartment within the house itself.
Within the big house, yes. Yeah. We have two floors, two rooms here and two rooms upstairs. So we got the apartment, and I was able to sell the house in Monkstown and build beside Loch Derg. So
it all happened together.
So yes. Yeah.
Oh, that's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. What year was it then when all of this happened? In the 50s, the beginning of the 60s, was it?
Well, I moved back. No.
This was 1979 when you finally came back in here again for the second time, but this time on a more permanent basis.
Yep. Yes. Yeah. Yep.
Living in this house now, did you sense the magnificent history behind?
Oh, yes.
All these doors?
Yeah. Yes, I know. There's no question about it. I mean, it's a privilege to live in a place like that. So, sorry, this is not the sort of house that I could afford. I could live in on my income as a civil servant.
but it's very much in the same way as it was nearly 2,500 years ago. And isn't it 17? Wasn't it around 17? The end of the 18th century when this house was built.
It would have been built in the 70s or 80s, yes.
Yeah. And people like Owen McNeil living
yes.
here.
Yeah.
And drilling, he's volunteers outside.
So the volunteers, we know they were, they were here. We used to, when it first came here, the kids used to pick up the odd spent bullet, but I think they've all been collected by now.
Really, there was, but was there any remarkable, you know, was there a sense of feeling about this place? Was there, I suppose, the ghosts of the past at any stage?
Well, the ghosts are very benign. They don't give anybody any trouble, certainly.
But they're here.
Yes. I mean, you have to. There has to be an atmosphere to a place like this. Yes. No question at all. It before McNeil bought it. It was a school for a boarding school for a few years. And it had various owners in the 19th century. And then our first landlord was a very interesting character, Arnold Marsh. He was a Quaker, and he was principal of Newtown School for a while. And he also, after he'd retired, he was interested in Drogheda Grammar School, which was on the verge of fading out, and he offered to work as principal, I think, for no fee at all, and got the school back and up and running again, and it's thriving now. But the reason that he came here in 1939, he'd decided to give up school and take to market gardening. And he looked around for a nice piece of land, found this, and we understand that the house was thrown in for half nothing because nobody wanted a house of this size in 1939. The house just a little way up the hill, Kilakee House, was actually it was just simply abandoned, and there's no. I think generally the any materials were just taken away. There is a fan light from it down in which somebody took, but I mean, that was really nobody wanted big houses then. Or could afford to do very much with them. Mm-hmm. So Arnold, and he decided then to divide it into apartments, and his very first tenant was Professor Levy, who was a German, a refugee from Germany. And he was Jewish, and he and his wife lived here and reared two, a boy and a girl, who actually married a brother and sister, and they were all living here when we first came here in the 60s.
How many families? So you had
There's about six families.
Six families. Oh, yes. My goodness, yeah.
Yeah. And then Arnold's wife was a painter, Hilda Roberts. She was in the 30s. She was sort of one of a group with Anne Yeates and Nora McGuinness, and really spoken of in the same tones of respect. She was a very, very fine portrait painter and good landscapes as well. But I think when she married, she produced very, very little after she married. So Nora and Anne Yeates continued, but Hilda faded out. They still do, and she is one of the, not quite in the top, but very, very close to the top bracket of Irish painters.
Right. I hear your dog barking away outside. I'm going to close the door.
Yes.
With all those lovely noises, I mean, you'd think of old houses as places to you know, that generally, you know, would give you inspiration for your work, and looking out these magnificent Georgian windows at such a lovely landscape.
Oh, yes.
You're looking down at Dublin here, Dublin City.
Yeah. And, again, the sighting is wonderful. We're on the close to the 500-foot contour. Now, the county development plans, the land higher than that is restricted for I think recreation and agriculture or something. I think that's how they say it. But the point is that they will only allow very low density housing up the hill from here. So the houses are being built right, left and center down below us. But the country is going to be maintained higher up.
And well, that's nice to know that, that there aren't going, it's going to be no development up here near you.
And I think the council will probably succeed in keeping to that plan, because the mountainside is just so popular. I know, hundreds or maybe thousands of people walk out past us every Sunday afternoon. And so I would think there are probably a good lot of votes in keeping the hillside open.
Going back to your work again as an assistant inspector of fisheries.
Yeah.
And this was for the whole country? Or what territory?
For the Republic, but I did work in all parts of the country, because I had other jobs which included fish farm development, and also if anybody wanted advice on how to make a fish pond or something like that, I was one of the people who would go and help them.
Well, which your main interest in the eel that you did your PhD on.
Yeah.
In the 1960s, you had the ESB. They caused a lot of damage, didn't they? In North Tipperary at Loch Derg.
From the Shannon scheme.
From the Shannon scheme. People earned their living from eel fishing down there.
Yes, but they continued to. So I think they possibly didn't make any serious difference there.
Did you notice that?
I wouldn't have been. Nobody would have been in a position to do that. But they actually, they employed an eel manager, a marvelous man called Paddy Meskell. His father had been an eel fisherman before him, and he was one of the people who was bought out by the ESB. So what the ESB wanted to control the fishing completely, and they had a great idea that they could catch all the eels at Killaloo. There had been a number of fisheries up and down the river, and they had this great idea that they could catch them. Well, all the eels have to go out through Killaloo anyway, so that was fine. But I've a feeling that the planning behind it was probably the work of engineers and accountants who didn't realize that eels aren't actually pieces of wood and that they're rather good at swimming past nets. So, a nice story about that is that I met a bank manager in Blanchardstown, where our fisheries lab went to Blanchardstown, to Abbottstown, and the bank manager said, he was very interested to hear I was in eels. He had been a bank manager in Athlone when the ESB paid the fishermen compensation, and he said, I helped them to bank their money. And he said, but of course they kept on fishing.
And the story, I mean, the eels, they were badly affected though, weren't they, with the Shannon's?
Well, they did put in they expected that the young eels would move in through the lock gates and things like that, but they certainly would have been upset for a while. But then in the 60s, they actually put in a pass for the elvers, the young eels moving upstream, and they did put a lot of effort into bringing them up.
Did you surely noticed as well, just moving on a little bit, that the fish were getting a little bit scarce now on the ground, because they are in the ponds and in the rivers, because you had a lot of pollution going into the water, something that never happened before the 1960s, say, you didn't have so much pollution
Well, if you take if you take the Dodder, the river that that's flowing past just a little way down the hill from us, there's an 1850s description of the Dodder in William Hancock's History of Tala. It is as black as porter, and animals have died from drinking it. That was 1850.
And what was happening to the
water? That was paper mill waste. By and large, rivers are very much better than they were in the 19th century. The Liffey was an open sewer. My great-grandfather was probably the principal designer of the sewerage system that got the sewage out of the Liffey.
Who was your great-grandfather?
Spencer Harty, his name was. He was a very interesting character. And he was quite remarkable. He was city engineer of Dublin, and quite remarkably was awarded the freedom of the city, which I think probably the only official ever to get that honour. It's usually given to sort of world figures but he was actually an official within the corporation and was given the freedom. But he seems to have been very well respected, had a lot of He wouldn't have been a socialist, but he certainly believed in the welfare of his workers and did a lot of work on their behalf.
But he sorted out the sewage.
But he was certainly very much involved in the Dublin sewage, yes, and also was also involved in the Vartry reservoir, the water supply from the Vartry. That was another of his achievements.
And he was your great-grandfather?
My great-grandfather, yes.
In your maternal side?
Yes. Yeah.
that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. And another fascinating snippet is that Spencer Harty was was city engineer. A man called Carter Draper was Wicklow County Surveyor, and was also involved in development of waterworks and sewage treatment. And my guess is that they would have known each other professionally, that the two families would have known each other, and so my grandmother and grandfather would probably have met through that professional attachment.
And interestingly enough, your involvement yourself in the waterways.
In water, yes. Yeah.
But in how many years were you in that post?
Nearly 40.
I
took slightly early retirement. But yeah. it actually was, well, we went from being purely civil servant, we went to semi-state when the Marine Institute was set up about 10 years ago or so. Mm-hmm. And I took a slightly early retirement then.
Were you involved in the fishing ports closing down around the
not at all. That was because I wasn't involved in sea fisheries. We were at the time, we were all the one department. I think two or three departments are now taking care of fisheries. They've created a good bit of chaos in the last 10 years.
What about the your brief, what you were doing? Did you enjoy doing what you were doing?
Very much, yes. Yeah. Oh, no, I had a really had a very good, very good, very pleasant professional life.
It gave you the freedom to travel and to see.
Yeah, a good bit of travel, yes. One of the beauties of eels was that they, very few people study them in any country. And so the only way of meeting a few friends and talking about eels at your own level was by having an international conference. And so we set up an eel working group, and we met in each other's countries for every couple of years. that really was very, very good fun.
There's quite a lot of folklore attached to eels in this country. Finding an eel at the bottom of a well, and if you do, you're guaranteed that your wish will come true.
Right. I wasn't aware of that.
But they're a sea and land, or sea and freshwater and sea creature, aren't
yes,
they?
Yes, they breed in the ocean, and they grow in freshwater. So they all, I mean, they have a quite fantastic life history, because all of the eels of Europe and of the east coast of North America, they all breed in the one place, in the Sargasso Sea.
And all coming from the one area?
Well, two parts of the one area, because the young are carried on the ocean currents, and you have the currents are one moving across to the Americas and one to Europe, and depending on where they're born, they get to the right place. And then the adults have to swim back against the current, which they do on stored up food. They don't eat at all after they start their migration.
Are they in low supply here now, or are they quite the same numbers as they were, say, 50 years ago?
The numbers have gone down drastically, maybe catastrophically. And nobody knows why, but in the 1980s, in the 1970s, were more elvers, the young eels, more than at any time on record. And in the 80s, the numbers went down by 10% and sort of continued to fall for a long time. They went down to 10% of the previous and continued to fall. And probably some changes that we don't understand in the ocean currents or something like that. But anyway, the numbers have got very, very small. And so the EU has imposed sort of quite stringent reduction on fishing. But in fact, I think the fishing is going to would probably die out anyway. Mm. It's hard work. And
how do you mean it's going to die out anyway?
Because there are far more easy ways of making far more money than an eel fisherman can possibly earn. It's as simple as that. The season's quite short. I suppose that is the one thing. But I calculated that the very best eel fisherman couldn't earn more than, I would say, at the outside, 20,000 euro. Now, anyone who has the intelligence and the stamina of an eel fisherman can earn a lot more than 20,000 euro, and he doesn't have to get up at 4 a.m. to do it. So I think that's will. And increasing employment. I mean, when there was unemployment all over, and when people were a hell of a lot poorer, then it was very, very important indeed. And the Loch Ness fishery in particular really made the difference for these about 400 fishermen as to whether they could live in Ireland or not. They would probably all have been for the emigrant boat if it hadn't been for the fishery.
They were able to earn
enough.
Traditionally, though, it wasn't really the thing to do in this country. It was maybe in England or in America. Yeah.
It's wherever it happens, it tends to be very, very localized. Loch Ney, it's an old tradition. The same Loch Corrib and Loch Derg and Loch Ree, both the Shannon and the Corrib Lakes and the River Barrow, there's quite a tradition of it. It is done, but always a small number. There aren't enough eels to be caught to provide a large number of people with a living. And also, as I say, it's hard work, because the traditional way was the long line. 1,000 hooks have to be baited every day with worms. Set about sunset, they have to be lifted at dawn. So you've got to do it every day, and that means it's lovely on a beautiful summer's morning, but it is no fun on a stormy summer's morning.
I recorded people on Loch Derg and Island Boar in particular, and
oh, yes. Yeah.
The Omaras and
Yes.
the Tirannans, they aren't there keep fishing for eel.
Yes, well, they are amongst the, yeah. And now, yes, having said that not many people are interested in it, those who do are obsessive. And I know some people who quite simply don't want to do anything else.
But that
But,
came to an abrupt end as soon as the Shannon scheme did come in. That's what
they
I
would have
was
been
asking.
bought out, yes. Now, in the 80s, the ESB then did allow people back again, back to fish for eels, and but I think they're probably trying to cut it down again.
Tell me
Yeah.
about, moving on. Tell me about you got married. What's your wife's name?
My wife's name is Sue. She's English, and though again, that was one of the amazing things. When she and her brother both came, they had been on a farm in Africa. They came to Ireland in the about 1948 or 49. Her brother went to Castle Park, where I was. She went to Hillcourt, which was a neighbouring girls' school. So I was actually aware of her existence. And well, I remembered her brother quite well, but I was totally out of touch with him. And then 1966, Sue decided she was wanted to do medicine. And she was, I think, 28 at the time. Trinity was one of very few colleges that would take a mature student, and so she came to Trinity. She, in her first year lectures, she sat beside my sister, saw the name, and said, "Which?" And I had a she had I had had an older sister who was at school with Sue. The younger sister was sitting beside Sue at a lecture, and Sue said, "Would you be any relation to Cherry Moriarty?" And so she was invited back home, and I met her. And I met her just a few months after having lost the previous girlfriend.
And did she have the same interest as you did then?
Not much. No. She's a historian.
Yeah, but in your writings, because you did write
But
about heritage and archaeology and history.
yes, well, she used to read what I was doing quite a bit.
She
Yes,
would
but
correct or
yes,
maybe
it
just
got some
proofread
very
that.
very useful corrections
Yeah.
indeed. Yes, yeah.
So it was a quite a an interesting partnership
Oh
then, and
yes,
working relationship.
indeed, yes, yeah.
Tell me about the you were missing from home for quite a while, because if you were traveling around the countryside and
Yes. Yeah.
looking after your job, and you had a young family growing up
Yes.
at the time,
We had two boys growing up. Yeah.
But
And
where did would you have gone? Did you, for example, was there a historical society here in this area or
I've ne never had very much involved. There is, I don't know if there was one, but there
But
certainly
you
is
never
at
got
least one
involved,
now.
yeah.
I never got involved in them. No, I guess I've been on the committee member of the RDS for since about 1980, and that takes a lot of energy. And then I joined the Quakers in the 70s, and Quakerism is a do-it-yourself religion. So I'm very much involved in Quaker work. We actually, well, one of my greatest interests, we have a library just immediately down the hill from here. It only moved out here about 3 years ago, but it's our Quaker headquarters is just down the hill now,
What
and so.
made you, what did, why did you decide to do that?
Well, I was Church of Ireland. For born up in brought up in Church of Ireland. Definitely I'm a mildly religious person. Wanted something. Also I'm an arrogant person, and where you have clergy, the clergy always believe, and they can't help it, they have to believe that they know better than you do. So, okay, you can discuss theology with a priest, but he always is going from a point of superiority. And also in the Church of Ireland, sermon is a very central part of the service. And a lot of the sermons were very bad. I really felt, no, I do not want my inferiors trying to preach at me. So I dropped out completely for a few years. And then, extraordinary coincidence again, a Quaker whom I had known a long time before and who I hadn't just been mildly in touch with after, he phoned me and said one of his sons was thinking of buying a fishery. Could I give him some advice on it? So I said, yes, of course I could. And I said, I'm glad you phoned me because I was thinking of going to you and talking about Quakerism again. And so I did. And so I started going to Quaker meeting and religiously never looked back. And I've got very, very, very much involved in the Quakers in Ireland. As I say, there's where you don't have clergy. The really positive thing is that if anybody wants to get seriously involved in running the religion, anybody can. Now, in fact, only about 10 or 15% of us want to do this. But for those of us that want to, the way really is open. And so I get a huge amount of satisfaction and interest from that.
Well, the Quaker tradition is with us since the 1600s.
And that's right,
you have, I suppose, just down the road from you, you have the Jacobs and the Goodbodies and the
Bewleys,
all these names are so successful. What is behind? Are Quakers generally driven people?
There's
business minded.
I think a lot of them are. There is in absolute integrity. It's one of very, very strong principles. And in the bad old days, Quakers refused to take an oath on the grounds that whatever you say should be true. And there is a little bit in the Gospels in which Jesus says not to swear. And the Quakers took that one up very seriously. And it actually led to imprisonment and all, because if you didn't take an oath of allegiance, you were then assumed to be a traitor and so on. So that was one. And that actually led to Quakers who went into banking tended to be more honest than everybody else. And if you're an honest banker, boy, you thrive.
Yes,
so Barclays and Lloyds were both Quaker names, Quaker foundations. But it went across the board in business. But there was also probably to a greater extent than average, the Quaker business people were very concerned with the welfare of their own workers, but they were also very, very progressive thinkers. Mm. So I think the Quaker entrepreneurs did tend to do very, very well.
I think they had their origins in Germany, is that right?
No, in England.
In England.
Oh, yes. England at the time in Cromwellian times, when there was a multiplicity of religions grew up, most of them, the Plymouth Brethren and the Baptists and so on, all developed about that time. A great many bit the dust after a few years, but the Quakers were one of the survivors.
And how many members in would you have any idea how many members?
We know exactly. It's between 1500 and 1600. It would actually be possible to tell you to the nearer to exactly how many, because we are we keep very careful records, mm-hmm. and each review the statistics every year.
Mm-hmm. And your wife, is she also?
No, she yeah. Is
it's
anything.
Just a yeah, just very personal
me. Yes.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the RDS.
Yes.
You're a member of the RDS.
Yeah. Well, the RDS has a science section and a science committee, and I've been involved in that for mm-hmm. a long, long time, since about 1980 or thereabout. And again, it's a very nice committee, very nice people to work with, so I stay there.
You've published some material. Can you give me an
yes.
idea? Give me an idea. What did you start with? What was the first publication
well,
that you
heard? The first thing was an article in the Irish Times. I in 1955, I went on with some friends. They were doing a tour. They had a yacht, and they were doing a tour of the Blasket and the Blasket Islands and the Skelligs. And they wanted somebody to record the wildflowers. And so my name was given to them. And so I had about a month touring the islands there. And I wrote articles about it for the Irish Times. So that was the first publication. I had written a short story at the age of 10. I still cringe at the memory of it. And I suppose it probably wasn't bad for a 10-year-old, but it was still, of course it was bad. But I definitely have had a desire to write for a very long time. School essays were appallingly bad, but for some reason I managed to improve after leaving school. I had a very, very interesting experience was the art teacher, there was Oisin Kelly, who very, very talented sculptor, but he couldn't earn enough from his art. And so he went into school teaching, and he taught English and French. A most delightful teacher, and rarely concentrated on exactly what he was supposed to teach us. We had wonderful class discussions. He was quite in advance of things at the time, because most teachers at the time just wanted to more or less lecture and say what was what and correct your copies. Oisin wanted discussion. And he was a first-rate teacher. The most amazing thing was that as soon as he began to earn enough money from his sculpture, he dropped out of it. And that had always been his intention. But he was obviously a man, whatever he did, he put everything into it. So I was very, very taken by him. A lot of what he was saying I did not understand at the time, but it sort of stuck in the memory. And I still, a lot in my sort of style of writing and thought actually comes back from what I got at school from him.
Indeed, yeah. And so you advanced your writings. Would they... how serious do you take your writing?
Oh, very, very seriously indeed. I mean, it's got I'm conscious of the need for accuracy above all. I'm also conscious of style, and I do I polish things. I mean, that's where the word processor has really changed my life, because when I was just typing, you didn't want to keep typing the page over and over again. But with the word processor, of course, you can make a small correction and get a perfect page, and so you have a lot more time for polishing.
What were the titles of your other publications?
Well, I did some radio talks on RTE about mostly about nature, and Frank McManus was the features editor at the time, and Sean Feehan, Mercia Press, wanted someone to write a bird book. And Frank gave Feehan my name. So that was my first book, A Guide to Irish Birds, in 1967. Mm. I wrote a little natural history of Ireland then. And then after I got my PhD, I wrote a fairly serious eel book. It got international publication. And then Follens, Albert Follens. Do you ever come across
I,
Follens?
yes, indeed.
Fascinating person. He was a passionate educator as well as being a very, very fine entrepreneur. So he produced or started on a series of books called the Irish Environment Library.
And what was your connection there?
I can't remember where or how he got my name. Possibly from I wrote a lot in the Irish Times in the 70s. Might have picked me up from there and brought me in as a consultant on a dictionary which he had hoped to publish, but which actually fell through. But then I wrote in quite a number of small books about one on songbirds, one on sea fish, and various other things. And then Elizabeth Healy, who was editor of Ireland of the Welcomes at the time, she asked me to start a series called Byways Rather Than Highways in Ireland of the Welcomes. And that was in 1986, and I've been writing a regular article there ever since.
I was going to ask you, what do you do in your spare time? But I'd say you
I
have
don't have
no
much.
spare time. It's you spend many hours, really behind, well, a computer now instead of pen and pencil. And you're continuing, your work is continuing, and what are you planning
I dropped
now?
out of fisheries research when I carried on a little after I retired, but then I found it quite interesting not having a laboratory to work with and other scientists meeting every day. It sort of the enthusiasm faded away. But anyway, lots of other things I wanted to do. So I've written the Wolfhound Press wanted to do a send Dublin centi what was it? Dublin Millennium book on the Liffey. And again, Elizabeth Healy, she was the editor, and she asked me, would I write a chapter or two? And I sort of looked at the contents list and decided I'd like to write nearly all the chapters, and so I did. And then that started a wonderful relationship with Seamus Cashman at Wolfhound Press, and he printed four or five of my books after that. And just last year, out of the blue, an Italian publisher wants to do a collection of aerial photographs of Ireland, and so I did the introduction and the captions for those. And I'm trying to write a book, write another book on the Liffey, but it's going very, very slowly. And just what I'm starting at the moment, started today actually, was to what I think will probably be a series of small guidebooks, probably county by county, for the Killarney printers, who are the proprietors very interested in that sort of thing. So.
Do you think there is still a lot more, kind of survey work to be done in the countryside that with the changing landscape now, it would have been so different to Dr. John O'Donovan's time, that the time to go over again?
I think it's unlikely that many more field monuments above the ground are going to be found. There is probably an awful lot buried, and I don't actually, I do, I am totally opposed to the Save Tara people because Tara isn't threatened by the road, and actually road building of that kind reveals a lot of things that nobody ever knew about, and the particular bit of the M3 is actually telling people more about archaeology than they could possibly have found out if they hadn't set out on the road. And I mean, to my mind, archaeology which is buried and which nobody knows about is really of no value to anybody. So there will be and a lot there is a lot more to find out, yes, But it won't be found out, I think, by people walking the country or even by aerial photography. Some things are turning up on aerial photography, which had not been visible before. But I don't see any great changes in that. I mean, really, one of my great interests actually is in how things develop and how things change. So I'm personally very, very happy with change. Interesting, if you take birds, the corncrakes have become very scarce because the method of haymaking has very nearly disappeared. And that's a pity, but there are a number. I mean, what's happening positively is, to me, much, much more interesting. You've got things like gannets moved in to nest in Ireland's Eye less than 20 years ago, possibly having never nested there before. And then the little egret is a very beautiful bird, which is spreading all over the country. So, okay, there are some losses, but probably far more gains.
Well, this would have been, I suppose, because of the climate change as well. You know, birds are.
I have a feel. The little egret might be climate change. I'm inclined to think it has a lot more to do with people getting much more conservation minded. And in the bad old days, anyone who saw a little egret would have shot it and got it stuffed. And I mean, that is now nobody in Ireland would want to do that now. And that goes much wider than Ireland.
And Christopher, finally, just tell me, what were your greatest moments? What was your highest moment in your life? And then I'm going to ask you about your lowest moments.
I'll tell you two or three. I won't say much about the lowest ones. I became chairman of my international organization, the European Inland Fisheries Advisory Commission. I chaired it for 3 years, and that was quite fun. I suppose one of the big memories is being part of the sort of celebrating clergy at the removal of Jack Lynch in Mount Argus. I was, as it happened, I was a Quaker clerk of the meeting. That's something that's always temporary, 3 years at the most you do it, but I happened to be the man on the spot. And effectively, when you're a clerk of Dublin Monthly Meeting, you're treated like a bishop. if a Quaker representative is needed, the clerk of Dublin Monthly Meeting gets the job. And so very, very satisfying too that as Quakers don't robe. And so the Quaker looks much more conspicuous than the priests in their white robes. Very, very unfair. So I suppose those are a couple of the... This is the biggest highlight in the life, utterly biggest in my life, was the marriage and birth of a first child. And nothing compares with that for me.
Oh, absolutely not. No. I'm glad you said that. No, because a lot of people would give preference to maybe something else. But no, that's very important. Yeah. Your lows.
Lows, one or two quite serious mistakes in dealing with fisheries, and I suppose their loss of a dog up a mountain, probably. I've been fortunate in that. Lots of people lose relatives, young relatives. The worst I ever lost was a dog. but it was still very, very terrible.
Yeah, it affected you.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Well, Christopher Moriarty, thank you. Thank you for telling me your story.
A great pleasure.